I'm Todd Presner. I'm the director of the Alan B. Levy Center for Jewish Studies. And it's great to see so many people out here today for this our annual lecture. I wanted to actually start in a somewhat unconventional way and say a couple words about another event that's forthcoming this weekend, mainly because you perhaps have heard a little bit about it and also the controversy around it. So we're doing a two-day conference in honor of the rabbi, activist, thinker, Abraham Joshua Heschel, this Sunday and Monday here at UCLA. I do encourage you, if you're interested in attending any part of that conference, to register ahead of time. We have capacity for several hundred people, but we also anticipate it being full. As you may know also from kind of the broader media controversy around one of our keynote speakers, Cornel West, I have written a piece that's in the Jewish Journal today articulating why the center, in collaboration with a number of partners at the university, the Department of History, English, the Center for Study of Religion, the African American Center, and Hillel, had sought out Cornel West as one of our 24 speakers. I do encourage you to read that. It gives an understanding of sort of where we were coming from, and also I think puts Cornel West in a broader perspective. I know many of you have expressed concerns to me personally and otherwise. I do also hope that you understand that at a university, we don't invite speakers because they are our mouthpieces, but rather because they have a significant track record and ideas that are worth hearing, even if we find those ideas not entirely agreeable. So I do encourage you to come out, and that'll happen this weekend. I do want to now turn to the event at hand today, which is a wonderful book that I came across about a year ago, which is also for sale in the back, called Dreamland of Humanists, Barbara Kazir Panofsky and the Hamburg School by Emily Levine. And as I looked at this book about a year ago, I realized that so much of what Professor Levine was articulating here spoke to concerns that we have had over the years by other lecturers talking about the cultural, intellectual history of Germany, especially on the edge, that is to say before the rise of Nazism. The richness of intellectual life and culture in the early part of the 20th century. Typically, when we think about that richness, we tend to be attuned to Berlin. We tend to be attuned perhaps to Munich, perhaps even to Vienna. Certainly at the end of the 19th and early 20th century, Vienna is of course a cultural capital. But Hamburg, perhaps a little unexpected. We don't necessarily think immediately when we think of Weimar Germany, of Hamburg, and yet the port city 200 miles to the northwest, as Emily Levine so elegantly argues, was really a unique and important setting for a diversity of intellectual and cultural life, particularly around art history, the history of art, aesthetics, philosophy, intellectual history, and even the transformation of the research university. It's not insignificant that one of the key players, one of the key protagonists in her book, Ernst Kazir, becomes the first German Jewish rector of a major research university in 1929. And by 1933 has fled Nazi Germany. Now, this is, of course, it's important to know that, but it's also important to know that the convergence of culture, of social issues, of economic issues, of ideas that was so rich in Hamburg is really about creating what she calls this dreamland for humanist thinking. She examines the conditions of possibility for knowledge. What was it about the context of Hamburg, this small but important mercantile city, which had transformed itself into a cultural capital in the early 20th century? What changes took place economically, socially, culturally? What changes took place in intellectual history? What was this unique matrix of space and time and people that came together to give it its particular cadence, its particular context? And what contributions can we learn, especially as we compare it to those other places that we know, like Berlin and Vienna as cultural capital? So it's a great delight to have Emily Levine here today to tell us about Hamburg as a cultural capital. I do want to say a couple words of introduction about who she is and also just extend some thanks. First is to Jim and Lori Keir, who are the trustees of and also really the inspiration for the Sadie and Ludwig Kahn directorship of the center, the chair in modern Jewish history, and also this lecture. So I do want to acknowledge their tremendous support to the center and for the tradition that we're very much honoring through this lectureship. I also want to acknowledge the Department of Art History as a co-sponsor, the Department of Germanic Languages, and the Department of History, all of whom were very enthusiastic about bringing Professor Levine here today. And finally, a couple words about our speaker. Emily Levine is professor at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, where she's been since 2010. She has held most recently an Alexander von Humboldt postdoctoral research fellowship in Berlin in 2012, and she received her PhD from Stanford in history, modern European history, in 2005. Her first book came out of University of Chicago in 2013. It's available for purchase if you're interested. Her work extends between intellectual cultural history, philosophy, modern European history, and she's completing a project right now on the history of the modern research university and transatlantic connections, I imagine, between Germany, America, and other places. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Emily Levine, and please join me in welcoming her.
Thank you, Todd, for that generous introduction. You said it so much better than I think I can. I feel like I should just go home right now. I'm really honored and delighted to be delivering this year's Sadie and Ludwig Kahn Annual Lecture in German Jewish Studies, and I offer my thanks as well to the Departments of Jewish Studies, Art History, and History for co-sponsoring the talk, as well as to Chelsea, wherever she is right now, for organizing the logistics of my visit. And thank you, most importantly, to you all for coming out on what is clearly such a glorious sunny California afternoon. I'm always reminded when I come to Los Angeles of the city's moniker as Weimar on the Pacific, named for the German luminaries like Theodore Adorno, Arthur Schoenberg, and Thomas Mann, who came here in the 1930s and left their imprint on the urban cultural world in music, film, and the arts. It raises a question that has intrigued me for years and to which Todd alluded. How does a city create the conditions for intellectual and cultural life? In their flight from Nazi Germany and in becoming American, the specific urban origins of German Jewish emigres are often obscured. Though the subjects of my talk today never made it to LA, Abby Warburg made it as far as San Francisco and then turned back, they were part of that emigration from a lesser known German city whose path nevertheless helped define a crucial moment in German and German Jewish history. Can you guys hear me okay? Okay, great. When the historian of art and culture, Abby Warburg, front right, was 13, and his younger brother, Max, in the center, only 12, Abby sold his share in his family's prominent bank to his brother in exchange for Max's agreement to buy him books for the rest of his life. Max, who would go on to run the family's business, M.M. Warburg Bank, later recalled, "This contract was surely the most careless business decision of my life." The joke was on him, because Abby's library, then a boyhood obsession, became the Warburg Library for Science and Culture, a major center for humanistic scholarship in the 1920s, and a collection of 60,000 volumes at its height, all funded by his younger brother. As a banker cum scholar, Warburg was acutely aware of the notion that I'll propose today. The contexts in which ideas and culture develop matter. For those ideas, for the intellectuals who create them, and for their reception. This afternoon, I'll first tell you a little bit about the main figures of this circle, Abby Warburg, Ernst Cassirer, and Erwin Panofsky, and their contributions to the fields of art history and philosophy. I'll then sketch how it was that their lives and works came together in Hamburg, Germany's second city, which enabled this intellectual community with its distinctive urban environment. And finally, I'll suggest how that city in turn became a unique site of Jewish intellectual history, and even changes our understanding of that very German Jewish history in the 20th century. Born the first of seven children to a banking family in Hamburg in 1866, Warburg became interested in art and culture at a very young age. He devoured all of the books in sight, a sign to his Jewish grandmother that he would not become a banker, but rather a rabbi. However, as the birthright story conveys, Warburg's rebellious spirit was already evident, and a rabbinical career was out of the question. So his family decided he was to become the next best thing, a lawyer. Yet at the University of Bonn, where he was sent to study law, Warburg quickly abandoned not only traditional Judaism, but also the law, in favor of what was then called the new cultural history, a scholarly concentration that was on the border of history and art history. The new cultural history was an approach promoted by such scholars as Karl Lamprecht and Jakob Burckhardt that aimed to integrate the Schatten, or the dark aspects of the classical heritage, into modernity. In fact, art history was still a fairly young field at this time, and its leading scholars were embroiled in disagreements about what it meant to study art in its historical context. Was art, for example, an expression of a time period, or rather a national characteristic, or alternatively the outcome of a sole individual's artistic creative genius? Like many Germans of his day, Abbe Warburg went south to Italy to immerse himself in the great masters and came up with an approach that, as we'll see, had as much to do with Hamburg as it did with the Florentine Renaissance. For Warburg's greatest methodological innovation was in seeing patronage, that is, the sponsoring of art and culture, as the crucial context for assessing artworks. Warburg's dissertation thesis took two famous paintings of the Renaissance by the Renaissance painter Sandro Botticelli, The Birth of Venus, pictured here, and The Spring. But he did not apply strict formal analysis to his critique. Instead, he incorporated an exegesis of texts central to Botticelli's wider circle, in particular from the Medici family, into his understanding of the artworks. And most creatively, he examined the role that the Medicis played in the sponsoring of those works in the motifs that he detected. And he came to do this by focusing on a specific detail, like flowing hair or the drapery and clothing. And then he would read sweeping societal transformations, the tensions between tradition and modernity, religion and secularism, into these small details. God lies in the details, the non-practicing Jewish Warburg was known to say. Unfortunately, for Warburg, the devil was in the details too. Warburg became preoccupied with these dark side of society that he believed was detectable in these images, the fits of madness that lurked behind an artist's creative genius, even enabled that creative genius. Warburg, for his part, was overwhelmed with the darkness, and he struggled with what scholars now believe to be manic depression, and ultimately succumbed to a nervous breakdown. Unable to complete a major study, Warburg wrote down aphorisms on little bits of paper and stored them away in an incredibly complicating filing system that's still searchable today in the archives of the Warburg Institute of London. After his promising and theoretically groundbreaking dissertation, Warburg never wrote another book again. Yet Warburg was not unproductive. By 1912, when that photograph I just showed you was taken, he was harnessing most of his intellectual energy for his budding library, which was organized around an interdisciplinary methodology that he was developing that he called iconology. A methodology that traced the development of images over time. Drawing on disciplines as diverse as anthropology, numerology, and the occult, Warburg sought to understand how gestures in images, like the detail of hair I described, reflected deep societal tensions between primitivism and modernization. His library of cultural science became singularly devoted to uncovering these contradictory impulses, what he called the Nachleben der Antike, or the afterlife of antiquity. Warburg's longtime collaborator and the director of the library, Fritz Zaxel, described the library's organization of books across its newly furbished four floors in 1926 as conforming to the law of good neighbors. According to Zaxel, quote, the first floor, which is featured here, began with books on the general problems of expression and on the nature of symbols. From here, one was led to anthropology and religion, and from religion to philosophy and the history of science. The second floor contained books on expression in art, its theory, and history. The third floor was devoted to language and literature, and the fourth to societal forms of human life, history, law, folklore, and so forth. End quote. That the ground level was devoted to symbols meant that library patrons began their bibliographic journey with the fundamental question of how human beings negotiate their relationship to the world, and then proceeded through various modes of mediation, from the elemental and the visual, magic and art, to the linguistically complex, literature and philosophy. Indeed, in the absence of a prolific body of published works, Warburg's collection became his life's work, and his library, a worldview projected through books rich with symbolism, continues to be an inspiration for the scholarly fields of memory, film, and visual studies today. The 1912 photograph conforms to our image of the lone professor who pores over a book by candlelight, tirelessly organizing and reorganizing his books into various categories around these themes, not unlike the lone creative geniuses whom he studied. But this image, however idyllic, belies the larger group of individuals and institutions that were a part of his enterprise. A library assistant who made his writings accessible, a secretary who cataloged hundreds of thousands of newspaper clippings and illegible notes, and a wife who, as she once remarked in the grand Jewish tradition, cared for her household's finances and her husband's mental health to enable him to pursue otherworldly pursuits. And it also obscures the intellectual community whose camaraderie and collaboration made this work possible. If Warburg is at the center of this triptych, he was flanked by two other scholars who used the resources of the library to achieve their potential and ultimately surpassed him in reputation. One of those scholars was the German Jewish philosopher Ernst Cassirer. A half generation younger than Warburg, Cassirer was born in Breslau in 1874 and studied in Berlin and Marburg, where he became known as the world's expert in the 18th century philosopher Immanuel Kant. If Warburg couldn't keep his demons at bay, Cassirer was made from the opposite intellectual disposition. Cassirer became part of a philosophical movement known as Neo-Kantianism, which argued that German philosophy had become unhinged in the 19th century by unwieldy speculation. Like other proponents of the school, including his famous mentor, Hermann Cohen, who chained a generation of German Jewish philosophers, Cassirer insisted that scholars needed to, quote, go back to Kant, to ground philosophy in rational inquiry based on the natural sciences. Cassirer wrote several books in this tradition, including an edited 10-volume edition of Kant's works and a biography of the philosopher that are still classics today. His international renown earned him visiting lectures invitations from Harvard and Oxford. But because of anti-Semitism in the German academy, he was unable to attain a full professorship or an ordinarius position in Berlin, at any German university, and spent 13 years as a Privatdozent or private lecturer in Berlin with no institutional rights and with his only salary derived from student lecture fees. And by the way, Cassirer was in good company in this respect. The esteemed sociologist Georg Simmel, whose Berlin lectures on Kant Cassirer had attended, also remained a Privatdozent his entire career, his predicament having only one explanation, as Simmel liked to say, I am a Jew. However, in 1919, the world was changing, And the shift would have an impact on both Kassir's scholarship and his career prospects. Warburg and Kassir's lives collided in the summer of 1919 when the new University of Hamburg opened and, likely prodded by Warburg's suggestions, offered Kassir, at the age of 45, his first real university job. It was a time, as Saxel later remarked, when hope was in the air. Although we should say that Hamburg was by no means immune to anti-Semitism. Kassir got the job despite his Jewish faith, as one faculty member explained. And this contradiction would follow Kassir into the Weimar period. In crucial intellectual ways, too, the university founded in the spring of 1919 quickly came to reflect the post-war world and changed the assumptions with which philosophers approached their work. Suddenly, after such unprecedented destruction, it seemed that reason couldn't explain human action anymore. Many scholars of Kassir's generation decided that a new way of thinking was required to analyze the world around them. In this context, Kassir created the concept of symbolic forms to describe a more expansive human interaction with the world that included, among other avenues, myth, magic, and symbol, the very categories of Warburg's library. So when he visited the library in the summer of 1919, Kassir was amazed to find it an almost uncanny physical incarnation of his burgeoning philosophical schema, a collection that Saxel called a magical coincidence. Kassir remarked many years later, quote, "I was strongly impressed by this first inspection, and it was by this impression that I was encouraged to pursue a study that I had been planning for many years, to give a systematic analysis of the problem of the philosophy of symbolic forms." Kassir's decade in Hamburg was his most productive period. He published a number of works, including the first two volumes of The Philosophy of Symbolic Forms, in which he extended his neo-Kantian framework to produce a broad philosophy of culture. And the synergy between Warburg's library and Kassir's philosophy made that work possible. Even while Warburg was still recovering from his post-war nervous breakdown in a sanitarium in Switzerland, he and Kassir had already begun to build a strong intellectual and personal relationship. By the time Warburg returned to Hamburg in 1926 for the library's official opening, Kassir was a self-professed regular of what he called the Arbeitsgemeinschaft, or the working group of the library. Kassir came to validate Warburg's life work and his intellectual vision for the city. And Warburg's library made it possible for Kassir to complete a three-volume philosophical work for which he would become the most famous. Now, it was the third of these scholars, the final component of our triptych, that would have the most reach, especially in post-war America and the English-speaking world. He was Erwin Panofsky. Panofsky was the youngest of the three. He was born in Hanover in 1892 and educated in Berlin, Freiburg, and Munich. He was a man of undisputed talent, with a prize-winning dissertation on the German Renaissance artist Albrecht Dürer. He was also the most ambitious and strategic of the three, and determined to avoid what he called Jewish purgatory, or the position of the Privatdozent. When Panofsky arrived in Hamburg's unformed art history department, he was not yet 30 years old, and he was, to his dismay, hired in 1920 under precisely that precarious title. But he quickly climbed the ranks to become an ordinarius professor in 1928 and a leading figure of the still nascent field of art history. Panofsky exhibited an anti-establishment character, both in life and scholarship. He was charismatic and a handsome presence who held office hours in the local pub. The group often moved over to Hamburg's red light district, St. Pauli, around midnight, where his learned and bourgeois Jewish wife, Dora Neymasi Panofsky, a daughter of the well-known publishing clan from Berlin, held court while philosophizing with prostitutes. And the spirited and laissez-faire atmosphere went hand in hand with his bold intellectual challenge to the two predominant schools of art history in his day. locked in an intense struggle over the question over how to describe art scientifically, Heinrich Wolfflin's school advocated formal analysis, that is, the analysis of shapes, lines, and colors, while Alois Riegel's Vienna school focused increasingly on national characteristics. For Panofsky and a growing group of scholars, it was clear that one couldn't ascertain a work's intrinsic meaning if you just applied the formal analysis. And yet he was also wary of the racial implications of connecting art to any national style. One required texts and knowledge outside the painting itself, Panofsky thought, to get at that deeper meaning. And we can see this approach at work in a simple but powerful example that Panofsky often invoked and would later play a role in a central role in his seminal essay on this methodology. In this frame, we see Claude Monet's Luncheon on the Grass, as I'm sure you recognize, from 1865, and Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel. And I purposely set this up like Wolfflin's so-called two-slide method. If you were conducting a formal comparison of these paintings, you might be drawn to, for example, the lounging men, right, on either side. Needless to say, there's a tremendous difference in the symbolic meaning of these picnics, right? That may seem obvious to us, yet in fact it requires knowledge of the time period to understand that one of these picnics is a leisure scene in a budding industrial European climate, and the other depicts the fall of man in the High Renaissance. Panofsky once said that without the appropriate context, the Last Supper would seem no more than an excited dinner party, right? That is, one cannot just look at shapes, colors, and lines, but requires much more research and investigation beyond the painting to decode its meaning. To do this, he drew on Warburg's unfinished insights about placing art in its social context, as well as Kassir's philosophical concept of the symbolic forms, and created a new methodological program that together they called iconology. Iconology was the methodological contribution that became the circle's greatest legacy. It encompassed a holistic approach to the study of art and images over time. It utilized those thousands of books from diverse fields housed in Warburg's library to place artwork in its historical context. For Panofsky, as for Warburg, one needed to be able to identify the symbolism of objects in a painting in order to uncover that intrinsic meaning. That was the work of an iconologist. As such, Panofsky was soon credited with being a founding thinker in the field, for he made art a legitimate object of historical analysis, like the natural sciences, with clearly established rules of a field, a process of inquiry, and a guiding methodology. For that, Panofsky became a cornerstone of what we think of as art history today and is still regularly read in undergraduate and graduate art history courses. Art historians and philosophers have written about the scholarly contributions of Warburg, Kassir, and Panofsky that I just sketched. However, as a historian of ideas and culture, I believe that the most pressing dilemma is this. Great ideas and great art, by definition, transcend their time and place. And yet those ideas and art clearly come from somewhere. In fact, it's the same dilemma that sent Warburg to the Medici financial records to uncover the intrinsic meaning of the Renaissance. The problem that iconology tried to solve was, how do we preserve the sanctity of art and ideas on the one hand, and also account for their emergence as historians on the other? In the second half of my talk, I'd like to suggest that the Warburg circle should be understood in the terms they laid out for their own objects of inquiry, that is, balancing text and context in a holistic analysis. For these scholars, just like the subject matter that they were analyzing, came from somewhere. They were individuals who could choose to write about whatever they wanted. And my suggestion is that the city, with its longstanding cosmopolitan spirit and republican tradition, its new university, and its merchant families, enabled and nurtured an intellectual community that would not have been possible elsewhere. Warburg reportedly said that he was a hamburger by birth, a Jew by blood, and a Florentine in spirit. And it's the first of these elements that I'd like to emphasize, because I think that this multifaceted identity converges in his Vaterstadt, the city of Hamburg, the real main character of this story. And that character complexifies our portrait of Weimar Jewish culture. Hamburg has long confounded German historians, challenging our generalizations of Germany as autocratic, aristocratic, and insular. As an imperial free city, a legal status awarded by Emperor Frederick I in the 12th century, Hamburg enjoyed republican self-rule by a local senate whose members came from merchant families and whose politics balanced local and international interests. This was only the first of a number of characteristics that it would share with the Weimar Republic, Germany's beleaguered experiment with democracy that lasted from 1919 to 1933, and which also straddled the German and the European, the national and the cosmopolitan. For most of its history, Hamburg was not known as a vibrant cultural intellectual center. It was famous as a commercial city, center of banking, the site of the major shipping company, the Hamburg America Line. Hamburg was and is, above all, a city where money mattered. In fact, in contrast to Berlin's current tagline that it's poor but sexy, if you asked any Berliner today, guaranteed, they'd probably tell you that the port city northwest of the capital was, in contrast, rich but boring. Yet Hamburg's mercantile tradition offered unique possibilities for its Jewish citizens. Because its political structure was organized around volunteers from notable classes rather than a professional civil service, political decisions were made mostly on economic concerns, including those of shipbuilders, property owners, and industrialists. Though mercantile cities aren't by definition more tolerant places, there's no doubt that Hamburg's "we'll do business with anyone" mentality benefited Jews. As early as 1802, the Johanneum Gymnasium that Warburg attended admitted Jews, including the Hamburg's chief rabbi, the son of Hamburg's chief rabbi, Jakob Bernays, who went on to become a renowned philologist. And after the loosening of state restrictions in 1868, Hamburg Jews enjoyed many rights still not available in other states. They could live wherever they desired, join previously exclusive trade guilds, and marry Gentiles. The Warburgs clearly benefited from this openness, referred to by locals as the King of Hamburg. Max Warburg served in Hamburg's Citizen Assembly and in the Chamber of Commerce. That Max was a so-called Kaiserjude who advised the emperor alongside Hamburg's most powerful shipping magnate, the German Jew Albert Behlin, who was the head of the Hamburg America Line, reflects, I think, the central role that Jews could play in Hamburg industry. Still, there were limitations to Hamburg's inclusiveness. Beyond their business interactions, Jews and Gentiles didn't mix at the stock market. The two groups occupied separate tables during social hours. And Moritz and Morberg believed that such segregation reflected the inevitability of the Warburgs' exclusion as Jews. When the 30-year-old Max considered running for a seat on the Senate, Warburg's senior advised, "That is not for us. You will surely not be seen as a co-equal." In short, the Warburgs were accepted, almost. In the Weimar Republic, these contradictions only became more acute. In that politically tumultuous era, the Senate opened to Jews and appointed a Jewish mayor. When conducting business with Jews was no longer an option in 1938, Hamburg's tolerant spirit burned not so bright. If in the Third Reich, Hamburg's local authorities administered anti-Jewish policy towards Warburg and Company in a way that preserved the bank's autonomy and protected its interests, this was surely less out of genuine sympathy than regional economic concerns. The 19th century German Jewish poet Heinrich Heine, famous for his scathing satires, wrote that Hamburg's businessmen liked money so much they would turn into gold. He complained of these businessmen's Philistine ways and the utter lack of culture among deep-pocketed merchants. Historians who write about German culture seem to share this prejudice, focusing on Berlin, which has become synonymous with the Weimar Republic, with its memorable modernist urban streetscapes and vaudeville cabaret scene. But the problem with this portrait is that after World War I, there was also a liberal and democratic moment in politics that swept Central Europe and Germany. And that positive moment is lost in this Berlin-centric story. That is the lost story of Hamburg and the new university that it represented. The full implications of the possibilities intrinsic to Hamburg's urban identity were borne out in the lives of Warburg, his family, and the community of scholars that came to gather around the new university that the Warburgs helped found in 1919. And here you see the building that was endowed in 1911 by another shipbuilder, Edmund R. Siemers, which serves as the center of the university even today and is inscribed with the words Der Forschung, der Lehre, der Bildung, of research, of teaching, of learning, of education. The outcome of a protracted dispute between scholars and bankers, the University of Hamburg was the object of the aims and anxieties of the scholars in the city that was never known for its intellectual life. And it finally came to fruition in the spring of 1919, in the moment known as the Dreamland of Armistice, following the armistice of World War I and before the Treaty of Versailles was signed, when the Germans were still hopeful that they would be incorporated back into the international community and assume a central role in the new Europe of the 1920s. Many Hamburgers welcomed this charge and believed that its city was the rightful inheritor of this legacy. Hamburg, after all, had been a member of the medieval consortium of northern European port cities known as the Hanseatic League. And though that free trade group was long dissolved by the 20th century, Hamburg still defined itself not in terms of Prussia, what they thought of as Germany's backwards hinterland with its famous goose-stepping soldiers, but as part of a wider Atlantic world. And I just want to emphasize that point kind of geographically. I know Todd is engaged in much more sophisticated GIS mapping and hypercity links. This is a fairly elementary map, but it makes the point, I think, well, which is that Berlin is practically in Poland, right? Then part of Prussia. Hamburg, in contrast, sees itself as part of this northern Atlantic tradition. It's critical to the identities of the elites in the city. A Hamburg senator used to tell a joke, I think, that illustrates this point well. His daughter had just taken a position as a nurse in the neighboring county called Schleswig-Holstein, which, since Bismarck had been part of Prussia, it couldn't be more than 10 miles south of Hamburg right there. And when the fellow senator learns of this, he says, "Oh dear, why did she have to move so far away? I could easily have gotten her a job in New York." Right. For these Hamburg elites, New York and London and Buenos Aires were just around the corner. They didn't share anything with Prussia. Now, joking aside, this local patriotism translated into cosmopolitanism and openness, and these conditions had an impact on scholarship and scholars. Hamburg had no state-sponsored art scene. It wasn't like Berlin, Munich, or Dresden. There was no princely patron who collected art and then turned it into a big municipal collection. In this respect, Heine, who disparaged the mercantile city, was correct. But what Heine missed is that those Philistine merchants spent their money to promote culture. Its affluent cities devoted funds to the creation of a number of cultural institutions. By the beginning of the 20th century, the rich and boring city boasted a handful of museums, laboratories, the Warburg Library, and soon the university, which one student called the best-kept secret in the German Empire. And I bring this photograph back of the Warburg brothers because, as you can see, right, Abby here on the right is holding his hands out like a supplicant to his brother Max. In the center, we have Paul on the top left, and Felix and Fritz, and that anecdote with which I began, the relationship between banks and books, as they called it, was really a central, not just symbolic, but central to this relationship between commerce and culture that made that world possible. And they created that world in their image, a cosmopolitan city that shared more in political sensibility with the Atlantic world than it did with Prussia. And both of these features turned out to be important to Jews, not to mention women, who were welcome in its new privately funded institutions where they conducted innovative scholarship. That one-third of the money donated for the university came from Jewish philanthropists shows just how vital a role Jews could play in this homegrown cultural market. That the mayor chose not to publicize the identity of those donors shows that not all were comfortable with the scholars that private money bought. For many Hamburgers, Jew and non-Jews alike, Kassir's intellectual project to place Germany back into the European tradition was well received, for they viewed themselves as being just around the corner from New York. Yet for others, Kassir's ascent was viewed as a provocation. Warburg was highly attuned to what we might call these identity politics. In the Weimar Republic, culture and ideas were certainly political, and democratic politics seemed to hinge on the fate of the humanities. Kassir had put his faith in systems of thought that could unify a world of self-conscious, politically responsible subjects. And he saw Germany as playing a central role in this long-standing humanist tradition. As such, Warburg came to believe that the fate of Kassir, Hamburg, and the Weimar Republic were intimately intertwined. Now, the close link between the scholars, the city, and Weimar Jewish culture is illuminated by an incident in 1928 known in Hamburg as the Kassir Affair, an incident that brings together the themes that I've talked about so far, the city, money, and Jewishness, and which I'll turn to for the remaining amount of time. As I've said, Kassir's presence vindicated Warburg's life's work, his library, especially since Warburg's depression prohibited him from producing a substantial public legacy. So when Warburg learned in June 1928 that the philosopher had received a job offer from the rival University of Frankfurt, his reaction was nothing short of hysterical. Over the course of the month before a decision was reached, Warburg held long conversations with Kassir and agonized with his brother Max and with his assistants Gertrude Bing and Zaxel over what to do. He privately negotiated with Frankfurt's rector, he drafted a public statement for a special issue of the local newspaper, and he convinced Hamburg's mayor and one of its senators to solicit Kassir personally. Yet the meaning that Warburg attributed to this potential loss differed depending on the context. Warburg's exchanges with non-Jews and his public statement on this affair reveal his anxiety about Hamburg's precarious intellectual identity. He invoked sympathy for the provinces in contrast to the Prussian university system. He published an article, Why Hamburg Should Not Be Permitted to Lose Kassir, and sent copies to influential citizens. And here again, he warned that Hamburg's identity as an intellectual city depended on Kassir, and drew on local pride in the Hanseatic city and its cosmopolitan a tradition in competition with its Prussian rival. Kassir decided to stay in large part due to Warburg's tireless efforts. He also received an invitation to give a high-profile university address, a raise, and a hint that he would become the university's next rector. It was a sweet retention deal, I must say. Warburg succeeded, as he did on a number of occasions, in refuting notions of Hamburg's intellectual wasteland. But Warburg's private correspondence from this period indicates that something else was at stake, namely Hamburg's German-Jewish tradition. In confidence to his brother Max, Abby shared his fear that the true meaning of Kassir's departure meant a loss to the German-Jewish community. Quote, if Kassir goes to Frankfurt, then Kassir's star pupils surely will follow him, and that holds symbolic meaning for the individual. The organic potential for growth of the inherited German-Jewish constitution would suffer an incurable blow, end quote. Warburg echoed this sentiment in the diary of the Warburg Library that he shared together with his assistants. This domino effect was dangerous, Warburg warned, because Kassir's student was meant to be a, quote, representative of the next generation who would carry on the torch of the German-Jewish spirit. And Warburg worried that if he left, he'd take his student and Hamburg's future and present German-Jewish culture with him. Warburg's utterance references to his Jewish inner circle, being in Zaxel, we're also Jewish, complexifies more than it clarifies Warburg's Jewish identity and the identity of the Warburg Jewish identity of the Warburg Library. To be sure, the Warburg Library was certainly not a library of Jewish science. It was also not anything like what would resemble what would come to be called Jewish studies. Even more confusingly, Warburg denied access to such Jewish organizations as the Wissenschaft des Judentums that he thought would tarnish the library's secular reputation and even kept the German-Jewish scholar Gershom Scholem at arm's length. Conversely, Warburg welcomed attention in the nationalist and even anti-Semitic press. The drama of Kassir's retention deal reveals in a brief moment what is so difficult to pinpoint about Warburg's Jewishness. For Warburg, Kassir's success in the secular realm reflected pride back on the Jewish community. This idea is, of course, challenging for a historian to prove, since moments of Jewishness in the circle of secular German Jewish intellectuals are often opaque. And historians will warn that identifying secular Judaism risks falling prey to essentialist notions of Jewishness to which the Nazis themselves ascribed. Yet, what I find most interesting is that Warburg clearly spoke in different registers depending on the context. As a result, the Kassir affair exposed the dual precariousness of Hamburg's intellectual and Jewish identities and the centrality of the urban setting for the production of ideas. The outcome was significant not only for Warburg, but also for the Weimar Republic. Warburg's cultural and political positioning in the Kassir affair reveals the essence of the academic and social politics in Germany's new democratic republic, perhaps in any democratic society. In the shifting priorities of particularity and universality, Warburg's negotiations offer an example of Jews' perceptions of their relationship to different audience. In the wider urban context, Kassir was renowned as the best Kant scholar, essential to Hamburg's intellectual reputation. In the particular Jewish one, Warburg felled, concerning that Kassir's success in the wider world of secular scholarship made him the bearer of the torch of the German Jewish tradition. Warburg linked this formulation, what I call the private Jews and public Germans, to the unique possibilities of Hamburg. In this way, the focus on the city changes our understanding of both Warburg's Jewishness and Weimar Jewish history. It's telling that in the Kassir affair, Frankfurt emerges as the urban competition to Kassir's tenure in Hamburg. And if I had more time, I'd fill out why that intercity competition was so symbolic. But in brief, Hamburg and Frankfurt shared much in common institutionally, intellectually, and religiously. And no doubt this similarity represented part of the threat to Warburg and his cultural aspirations for Hamburg. For although both cities were essentially commercial, only Hamburg's cultural reputation had suffered as a result. Moreover, there's reason to believe that Warburg saw evidence of a backlash against Frankfurt's Jews. His interest in avoiding a similar perception problem in Hamburg motivated his strict private-public division of Jewishness. In light of this urban comparison, Hamburg's mayor's decision not to publicize the overwhelming contribution of Jews to the university seemed justified. Indeed, the comparison highlights Warburg's remarkably similar, yet distinctively different private Jewish and urban identity. So to conclude, the city provides a new frame for the understanding of Jewish life. In Hamburg, a constellation of institutions created the possibility for an inclusive culture of what one scholar has called in the French case of Jewish republicanism. Despite Warburg's careful positioning, one of the tragedies of this tale is that anti-Semites, of course, viewed Kassir's success in the secular realm as Jewish rather than as universal. However, this doesn't make these scholars delusional, nor should it detract from a careful reconstruction of this time and place in which Jewish life took a distinct path, one which has consequences for us today. 1933 casts a dark shadow for anyone who researches German Jewish history. Yet the ending of this story changes depending on what and on whom we focus. Abby Warburg would die in 1929 and not have the experience of trauma, of war, and of exile. In 1933, when Hitler came to power and Jewish professors were fired from the universities, Ernst Gassir would go into exile, ultimately arriving in New York City. There he would spend the last years of his life before dying in 1945 on the steps of Columbia University. As for Panofsky, symbolic indeed. In spring of 1933, he was on leave at New York University when he received a telegram notifying him of his dismissal that came with, as he liked to remember, cordial Easter greetings. He would remain in the U.S., first at NYU's Institute for Fine Arts, and then at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton, where this photograph was taken in the 1950s, and where he and his wife, Dora, were known around town as Pandora. The Warburg Library also went into exile following negotiations between the American Warburg brothers, various London donors, and the Nazis, mediated in part by Panofsky, which nearly 60,000 books were, along with various machinery, were loaded onto two ships of the Hamburg line, the Hermia and the Jessica, and sailed to the London port in December of 1933. Samuel Courtauld then supported its incorporation into the University of London in 1944. And as if you may have read, its status as a partner institution of that university has been financially and legally precarious, though temporarily resolved in mediation in London. I would argue that in these passages, the Hamburg School, as Panofsky called it, became more, not less important in exile for these figures, where it assumed sharper focus and meaning as a site of the origins of their ideas and collaboration. We see it in the correspondence of Panofsky, despite his transition to becoming a founding member of art history in this country. Dora Panofsky, for her part, insisted until the end of her life that Hamburg was an oasis in Germany, as she called it, different even now. The war created a break, not just in the history, but in the writing of history and the ability to tell the story of pre-Hitler Europe. By focusing on a distinctive city, I've tried to avoid some of that inevitability and make that lost world more concrete. In particular, by revealing how its cultural opportunities differed from those in Berlin. In interwar Germany, this meant that while anti-Semitism was certainly increasing on the national level and the political mood swinging to the right, in a city like Hamburg, which had a mercantile and cosmopolitan identity and had no Prussian past, Jews like the Warburgs could play a central role in the economy and culture. The Hamburg School responded with scholarship that highlighted the role that material conditions played for ideas and art. That is, they thematized this very problem. And that contribution would outlast its time and place, even if they would not. Thank you for listening to part of their story. I'd be happy to take a question.
Thank you so much, Emily Levine, for this really illuminating talk. And I'm going to begin with just two questions, and then we'll open it up to the audience. Both are kind of inflected by geography, I guess, since this was also a major point in this work. And really, I think, a motivation of decentering Berlin. One is, the first question is relatively just factual, and I'm interested particularly in the negotiations that led to the relocation of the library in December of 1933. So the actual, anything more you can tell us about the material, economic, cultural history that led to the library being packed onto these two lines and brought to London. What was possible? How was it possible that this happened? And just to give us a little bit more, because the library in many ways is is not, of course, just the material reality, but it's the symbolism as well, the kind of the most symbolic center of everything that the dreamland of the humanist represents in this book. And so I'm also interested in the relocation of that dream.
Yeah.
I think they simultaneously go together. Then my second question, also geographic, you had mentioned, I guess, offhand about the factual reality of Berlin and Poland being obviously very close together. It raises an issue, particularly that goes relatively unseen in the book, and then you certainly didn't mention it here, which is Eastern European Jewry. Mm-hmm. Right? Berlin is often characterized at this point as the beginning of Asia, right? As an orientalizing gesture. Carl Emil Franzos very famously said that at the Scheunenviertel, the Jewish ghetto in Berlin is the beginning of Asia. Now, what this meant really was it was the beginning of a kind of orientalizing notion of Jews of Eastern European descent, right? And I wonder, where are the Ostjuden in the story of Hamburg? And in fact, I suspect they may be there, but certainly the orientation towards London, New York, transatlantic, obviously Western Jewry, assimilated and cosmopolitan, is very different than that characterization of Berlin and its connection to Eastern European Jewry. So I wonder if you can speak to those two questions.
Yeah. Thanks, Todd, for those really probing questions. With regard to the as you put it so eloquently, the emigration of that dream, it's really a fascinating story. And it was sort of a move in the 11th hour of kind of what was possible with the transition to that regime. As I hinted, kind of Hamburg local authorities held out for longer than perhaps other cities that were being nationalized by the centralization policies very early on in the Nazi regime. And as I also hinted, that they didn't do this for any love of the Jews, but rather because all decisions in Hamburg were made based on money. One, and based on local pride, too. So when they supported, for instance, the annexation of Schleswig-Holstein and the Schleswig-Holstein question of Bismarck's expansion of the empire, it was largely for reasons of trade, right? And this was generally how they mediated between what was happening in the nation, and the connections to America became crucial to essentially permitting this property, the material property of the library, to leave the city at the end of 1933. They were basically able to argue in these various negotiations with the local authorities and with Berlin that this was in part American property, owned now by Paul and Felix in America. And that its rightful home should be outside of this new Third Reich. I should also say that the Warburg brothers really, they never were really interested in their, were invested emotionally in their elder brother's kind of crazy, eccentric bibliographic project. I mean, they kind of indulged him, and at one point Max says, other wealthy families have their horse stables. We have our library, and perhaps it'll bring us some, knockers in the world to come, he says, right? But once he dies in 1929, already in the correspondence, the brothers are sort of trying to unload the library. And already the correspondence begins to reflect this question about where it will go. And Panofsky raises the idea, once he's in New York, that maybe he can cultivate interest among these new institutes at NYU or other projects that are emerging in Princeton. The idea is raised that it should go back to Italy, that it should go to the Netherlands. But largely it's through the mediation of Panofsky and one of the other students, Edgar Vint, who would also go into emigration in London, that London ends up being the home. Somewhat haphazardly. And as Saxel says, when these books arrive, it was like arriving with 60,000 books and saying, be our friends, share our ideas. and it led to this other story in which then these ideas are translated culturally and linguistically into English and take very different paths in the UK and in the US, leading to different remnants, you could say, of the Hamburg school in exile. To answer your other question, I'm just going to address Todd's second question, and then I'm happy to take other questions about the other side of the geographical world, the Eastern European world. I think it's an astute observation that the Ostjuden are sort of in the shadows of this story. There were obviously Ostjuden in Hamburg. It was one of the ports, other than Bremen, by which that Russian Jews, Eastern European Jews, Polish Jews were leaving Germany. And you know, other scholars have charted that passage in which many end up staying in Hamburg. In fact, not as many as you'd think, and one of the speculations is because they weren't all that welcome. When the cholera epidemic happens in Hamburg in 1892, that is a moment at which racial tensions flare up, and the East European Jews get blamed for sort of contagion, and there's a horrible incident where they're sort of locked in these train cars at the port and not allowed to leave for fear that these Ostjuden are going to contaminate the rest of the population, and the Jews, the Hamburg Jews certainly don't speak up on their behalf in a way that I think we would feel good about. Nonetheless, Abby Warburg becomes very disturbed about what's happening on the Eastern Front in World War I and how Jews are treated during the war. And this begins his actually obsession with the treatment of East European Jews and of Jews in that part of the world. And this is kind of one of the big moments of those aphorisms I was mentioning. The newspaper clippings he rips out about the treatment of Jews, and Max Warburg is very engaged in this issue, and Felix, who's already in America, will be involved in the joint and in advocating for Jews in Eastern Europe during this period. So there's a bit of a double-edged sword. You know, the Warburgs feel responsible to sort of help their own, but they're clearly modeling themselves on a different elite. And they're looking to the West, they're looking for the Atlantic as a way out in some ways of the tensions, I think, between Eastern Europe and Germany that characterize, as you say, Berlin and its doorway to Asia.
Let's open up to questions, and I'll try to call on one. So let's start with David, and then behind David.
Should I come over?
Start David, and then
I always assumed. I always assumed that the Warburg family in this country made their money from Western mining interests. How were they related? Were they the brothers, the Warburg brothers that you're referring to, or were they the sons of the brothers? And how did they get their money out of Germany?
So we're talking about the Warburg. So I'm focusing on the generation of the seven children of the brothers who were the children of Max M. Warburg. These are the brothers who go to America are Paul and Felix, who are on the top row, and they marry into the Schiff and the Loeb families in around 1900. Paul marries the daughter of Loeb of Kuhn Loeb and Company. His brother Felix marries the daughter of the Schiff. They're completely interrelated and become a kind of cornerstone of this sort of the American Jewish sort of banking world. That family in some ways departs from the story, however, that I tell, which is really about the bank in Germany.
But did they make their money in mining?
I don't know about the mining piece of that, of those American Warburgs.
Their money out of Germany.
Well, the American Warburg brothers, who already had moved their sort of careers and their career prospects to the banking world of New York, were amassing other wealth in America. So it was really separate from the German bank. And in fact, their American dollars were able to support then the Warburg Library during the inflation when the German mark, you know, collapsed in the 1920s. So they were really separate financial entities, as I understand it. I don't know as much about how the American Warburgs then went on to make their money. Yeah.
David,
thank you very much for a really outstanding lecture.
Thanks.
I'm curious about the ways in which we come to ascribe characteristics to cities, which is a complicated proposition. And you know, one thing that I was thinking about is that the Hamburg school that you described seems to lack, we might say, explicitly Jewish content, the intellectual products produced, say, as opposed to, you think of contemporaneous constellations of intellectuals in Berlin, of course, and even in Frankfurt. I mean, one could compare the Hamburg and the Frankfurt school, that would be a very dark comparison. But we have the Lehrhaus in Frankfurt, which adds that very powerful Jewish component. So I guess what I'm trying to think of is, you know, what is Hamburg contributing to the formation of this particular kind of work? And that's the essence, I think, of your book. But I'd like to just ask, I guess, about both synchronic and diachronic vectors. So synchronically, does the comparison of Frankfurt and Berlin illumine something about the distinctly non-Jewish, Jewish quality of the Hamburg school? And then I suppose somewhat in tension with that, we have a pretty interesting Jewish history over the long delay in Hamburg, beginning with the presence of Sephardim as major commercial agents. Mm-hmm. The Gulf Hamon makes her way there. The first major Reform temple, the clash between Reform and what will come to be known as Orthodox, the birth of Samson Raphael Hirsch. So there's a rich legacy there to draw on. It seems to be somewhat of a disconnect with the Hamburg school you described. So I wonder if you could shed light on the seeming convergence of these synchronic and diachronic
ideas. Yeah. Thank you for your excellent question. As you say, it really gets to the essence of the dilemma for me, which is, you know, cities are obviously not human, and in some ways I'm kind of personifying the city sort of intentionally by talking about the spirit of the city and about Hamburg as a character in and of itself, and I realize that that's somewhat problematic, and that's why I try to stay with the kind of characters themselves and the source, and sort of, because cities are obviously man-made. They're made by people like the Warburgs who project their dreams and their aims and their anxieties onto these places, and that's really the way that they come to talk about them in this spirit, and so I try to use those leading individuals to kind of show how they craft this and try to bring people sort of on board with this. And I think that the comparison to Frankfurt is such an apt one because, as you say, they actually share a tremendous amount, especially if we look at the histories of the universities, both created as so-called Stiftung Universities largely by private seed money initially. Right, in 1919, Frankfurt is founded in 1914, but it really doesn't open until 1919. So, in the spirit of the Weimar Republic, right, with a web of sort of extra university, also privately funded institutions that surround these institutions, including not only the Frankfurt Lehrhaus, but also the Institute for Social Research, right? And these institutes become characterized, you could say, also by liberal rather than kind of radical strands. They become characterized by these, in both cases, counter narratives that they're promoting about sort of Western society and humanities, the Renaissance and the remnants of antiquity being the one for the Warburgs on the one hand, and you know, this kind of dialectic enlightenment sort of that's emerging out of the Institute for social research. And so in that sense, at least they're on kind of parallel paths. But as you say, they're Jewish. The wider Jewish stories are vastly different. And I think where Hamburg has diverges on a unique path is precisely because of the history that you allude to. I think it was much more successfully pluralist in some ways than Frankfurt, right? Because of the arrival of Sephardim, because of the way that the departure of the Reform Synagogue broke from the community in 1818, it didn't actually end up breaking apart the community. They resolve it in a very different way, permitting the essential continuation of the community so that one could continue to be a citizen of the Jewish Gemeinde, the Jewish community, but affiliate with whatever synagogue they wanted. There was a sense in Hamburg that we don't kind of disrupt the peace, right? The Jews sort of have maintained order sort of in their personal affairs. And I think that really continues through to the sort of to the 20th century. And I think that pluralism is then reflected in the ways in which these, as you call them, the non-Jewish Jews in Hamburg are kind of moving in some ways in the same in the same wider concentric circles as the Jewish Jews, like the Karlbach family, also then in Hamburg. And when you read the Jewish community newsletter, the Gemeindeblatt, you know, there's pride reflected about Kassir and his achievements that are reported in these Jewish newsletters. And what I think is really interesting, and where then I focus my attention, is the way that is sort of what Kassir and Warburg and Panofsky then do with this, right? When Kassir goes to speak in synagogues, as he does on two occasions, including in 1933 in Berlin, he interestingly talks about universal themes. Whereas he does the same thing when Hermann Cohen dies and he's standing in front of his grave in 1918, he talks about Goethe. You know, it's this like incredible moment. You think Hermann Cohen is probably rolling over his grave. He uses this as an opportunity in some ways to open up Judaism to the wider world. In contrast, when he speaks as the rector of the university, he insists on talking about the importance of particularity for the universal dreams at the moments at which the Weimar Republic is being celebrated in 1929. And this is a very bold moment because the Weimar Republic is very beleaguered at this moment. And so I think you can really see the ways that particularity and universalism sort of interact in both tension and creative tension in Hamburg in a way that it doesn't happen for different reasons in Berlin and in Frankfurt.
So I'll do one and two.
I have a very small comment in that and on the question. I noticed that the rector, that Kassir, and his ruffles.
Yes, his white ruffle, yes.
Yes, can you go back to that?
Yes.
Well, that could have been painted in the Renaissance. Mm-hmm. And it astounds me that the university, well, it shouldn't astound me, I'm still surprised. That a university that was founded so late would appropriate such an antique mode of dress in what,
1919?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So since it is a university that's created so late, is it that they're trying to give themselves some aura of antiquity by dressing them up in an Elizabethan ruffled collar and traditional Renaissance necklace with all the honors and medallions? Or do you have any?
Well, I mean, university and dress in general is fairly antiquated. I mean, what's different about the Hamburg garb is the white ruffle that comes from the Danish, the Northern European tradition. But I mean, Panofsky used to say, though, that there, along with his friend Kantorovich, who was also a German Jewish exile, that there were three professions that wore the robe. You know, the judges, priests, and university professors, and they loved it. I mean, the performance was part of the sort of exhibition of the university, and though it was a modern university, it still had a lot of the trappings of the wider tradition of the university, and that was important for it in establishing its sort of bona fides in this wider world, and those traditions would follow the university to America in its American incarnation as well.
There was a question.
Yes. Given that you said that the university came so late to Hamburg, how do you explain that in the context of German history, that universities were so prevalent all along the Rhine, Bonn,
yeah.
Cologne, Heidelberg, obviously?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's exactly what makes Hamburg's case so unique, right? And I think that it's a long story about how the university sort of didn't come and then finally came to be. But the long and short of it is that, you know, merchants like the Warburgs didn't think that they needed one, right? They sent their sons to do tours in banks in London and Buenos Aires, as Paul would do, and Max would do. I mean, that was their training to then take their place in either the bank or in the shipping company that was the real heart and soul of the city. And so when the idea first was raised in the second half of the 19th century to have a university in Hamburg, a lot of the economic interests of the city felt that it was a waste of resources, and they simply couldn't compete with the universities that you mentioned that dated back already a few hundred years. I mean, and as good businessmen, they said, if we're going to found a university, then we have to have a good reason that it's going to fill a gap, and that we're going to have students to come, and that this will actually bring some resources, revenues, and pride for our city. And so it's not really until the war and the loss of the University of Strasbourg, the return of many soldiers who end up needing a new place to go, combined with the momentum from the Democratic Revolution and the hopes for a new Europe in the 1920s, that ultimately pushes the pro-university camp forward to found the university. And it's that belated founding that then has sort of this, all of these consequences, as I've tried to show.
So, I don't know, who haven't been called on yet, so go to the front.
You've portrayed Hamburg as being a very cosmopolitan and liberal city. How did it respond to the rise of Nazism as compared to other cities?
Right, that's a really good question. And this is where kind of, sadly, some of the city's histories start to, anyway, converge, right? I mean, part of the story of Nazism is that the nation comes into these localities. And as long as this unique mix of the liberal and the mercantile and the cosmopolitan reign in Hamburg, then it remains an open and tolerant place as I've described it. But as that Nazi government starts to expand outward and centralize and take over in the city, the proponents of that spirit of the city are hard pressed to do anything about it. I should say that it's really the students who bring Nazism into the culture. It's the students who radicalize the university, and that's where the fight begins in Hamburg as well. The right-wing students who are pushing against the first German Jewish rector of the university, protesting, in fact, his speeches that he's giving in 1929 and 1930. And so it's a city of contradictions, and I should watch sort of painting a too general a picture of Hamburg as liberal and cosmopolitan and the rest of the surrounding Germany as being the backwards and right wing, because these contradictions are there from the beginning with an affluent city that's also a hotbed for left wing socialism, and they continue through the 20th century with holdouts who leave Jewish and non-Jewish in protest of the new government, and those who never wanted the university or the Jews there to begin with, and happily remain to accept the new regime.
All right, David, then we'll come back to you one more time. All right,
David. I appreciated your last comment, and my question builds upon that thought of yours. I really enjoyed your historical trajectory of German Jewish cosmopolitan, beginning with the Weimar Republic and then onward. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what happens when you begin to move backward in time. In other words, think about the imperial past of Germany that precedes Weimar Republic. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important for a city like Hamburg, where you have the famous Karl Hagenbeck Zoo. Mm-hmm. Because that is the place where
right.
colonial history really intersects
yes.
with German urban history. That's the place where non-European others are exhibited
right.
in zoos for education and
yep.
entertainment purposes. The Bremen Line is also the place where Germany opens up to the colonial world.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder how your history changes when you move backward in time.
Well, the colonialism is a flip side, I think, of the cosmopolitanism. Just like these other contradictions exist, just like, the liberal socialism is the flip side of having an affluent city, and the disparity of wealth, follows this affluent city. So, I think that the darker history that you refer to of sort of of Europe's first zoo, is part of what came along with being a city that was a city of shipbuilders who had interests in Germany's fledgling colonial world. Not only were they open and tolerant and eager to emulate the British, they were also sort of, you know, wanting access to that colonial world. So I think that in some ways, again, you can see the contradictions, just as I was answering with the other David's question, with the Jewish history in that long durée. And of course, the Colonial Institute, which along with Berlin is kind of founded around the same time, right, around in the first decade of the 20th century, becomes the cornerstone then of the university. So as you're saying, it's central to then the character of that new modern university, which both has this colonial ethnography side as well as this more cosmopolitan, you know, new political science, international law kind of side. Yeah. So thank you for your question.
I think it must be noted that the former Warburg Mansion on Fifth Avenue in New York City is now the site of the Jewish Museum.
Yes, indeed.
Which is probably the largest and most famous Jewish museum in the world.
Yeah, indeed, yes. Here it is.
You go the corner of that, the back.
Tell me something about yourself. How did your interest in this particular subject emerge? Did you grow up in a German-speaking home?
I did not grow up in a German-speaking home, but I'll tell you one tidbit that you can get if you know it, that if you pick up the book that's I think for sale in the back of the room, which, small shameless plug, but we do that in LA, right?
Yeah,
we do that, yeah. Which is that I grew up Jewish and went to an Episcopal school and was already very early very fascinated with the interconnections between particularity and universalism. And the ways that sort of liberal and secular Jews navigate those concentric circles that I was talking about, and the ways that particular cities like New York, my hometown, produced a certain kind of condition for that mixing and that intellectual and cultural life. And I begin with a story that I won't give away now, but again, you can access it there. That sets the stage for that comparison.
Well, listen. Thank you so much, Professor Levine.
Thank you.